And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper still recovering from his back injury, and he's doing much better. Julia Cook's new book, The Other Side of Paradise, is her account of a 10-month stay in Cuba in 2009. Cook first traveled to Cuba when she was a college student. Fascinated by what she saw, she returned years later to get a better sense of what life was like in this tropical dictatorship. She befriended several young Cubans who introduced her to a subculture that rebels in its own quiet way against the restrictions imposed on them by the government. Whether you agree with the U.S. policy toward Cuba or not, Cook gives us an eye-opening look at a society that is misunderstood by many Americans. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Cook. He began by asking her if she ever worried that the Cubans would perceive her to be exploitative.
Absolutely. All the time. Yeah, frequently.
Because you are a white American, very privileged, at least by Cuban standards. How did you, how were you received?
Received, you know, one of my early writing mentors told me that that people oftentimes are very excited to tell their story. And that if you listen closely enough and attentively enough, and if you are present in the moment and not if your intent is genuine and you're not trying to exploit them, that will come across, and you have to have faith in your own ability to do that. So that attitude is kind of what guided my my presence in Cuba and my approach to talking to people. I was received with very open arms, very generously, by a number of people. There were some people who immediately saw that exploitative aspect of my presence, that very political, very exploitative aspect of any journalist's presence in any situation, any American journalist, any place that's not as privileged as here.
You first went to Cuba in 2003 when you were a college student. You were 20 years old. Then you returned in 2008 or 2009?
Well, I was back and forth with some frequency. I was there in 2004. I was there in 2003 for the first time, and then I studied there in 2004. And then I graduated from college, moved to Mexico City, began working as a journalist. And I did, between 2004 and 2008, I did two journalistic features in Cuba. So I did two or three long-ish trips, and then I started going back to research this book in 2008.
Okay. But you had to sneak in, didn't you? Because you couldn't go in as a journalist.
Yes.
How did you arrange that?
I just went in as a tourist. You know, tourists are very welcome in Cuba, and I was, according to the papers that I filled out, one of them. And then I just tried to be discreet as I could, conduct any research that I was doing quietly, respectfully.
At one point, though, you were found out. They were keeping a file on you.
Yes.
Because, again, journalists are allowed in Cuba, but they are surveilled. They are watched over. You were just walking around talking to people.
Yes.
How did they find you out, and what happened?
I will never know how they found me out, and thus far nothing has happened. That's one of the very bizarre things about Cuba, is that the Cuban state is pretty conscious of who is coming and going to a degree, and yet I don't know how. I'll never know who in my circle of people that I was acquainted with was reporting back. There was never any consequence to me.
But that's the thing, you see. The intelligence agency in Cuba is very competent. It's probably one of the few competent institutions in the country. They can't do anything, but they do know how to spy on people. And everyone can be an informer. That island is full of informers or potential informers, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what it comes down to is the fact that I was not interested in the politics of the place as much as I was interested in the people, and I was not interested in acting on the politics or participating in that mechanism or anything like that. I was really there to observe. And I think that that is what protects me. I think that the Cuban state is astute enough to understand that I am of very little importance to them. And so that kind of, that shrouded me in this kind of protected cloak.
Not anymore. I don't think you'd be allowed back in Cuba now.
I don't know.
You might not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Julia Cook, whose new book is The Other Side of Paradise, her account of her travels in Cuba. Let's look at some aspects of Cuban society.
Totally.
The gay community. Gays were persecuted by Castro and his government in the 1960s, quite vigorously. They were put in concentration camps, basically. How are they treated now?
They are treated quite well now by most standards. Gay marriage is not legal, but sex change operations are state funded at this point. If you are a transsexual in Cuba and you would like to transition, the government will pay for you to do that. So it's a place of some contradictions in that regard, much like here. But it's very clear that they're trying to make up for the terrible persecutions of the past. Mm.
Well, Raul Castro's daughter has been quite a gay rights activist.
Very much so.
Which is interesting. Why is she, do you know why she's such a strong proponent of
gay
rights?
I don't. I have no idea.
Yeah. It's just fascinating because, again, Fidel Castro's such a figure of machismo. Mm-hmm. That this was one of the reasons why he went after gays, because the revolution, he wanted to always be associated with manliness, machismo. Though, of course, there are many gays in Cuba.
Tons.
There are a lot. The gay community is very active, very thriving in Cuba.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about the subcultures?
Mm-hmm.
Because again, what I liked about your book was your examination of the subcultures. And there are many subcultures, predominantly young people belong to them. The freakies.
The freakies.
The freakies. Who are, and what are the freakies?
The freakies are the people who are fans of hard rock and punk rock. And in Havana, because there's not quite so much access to the different branches of hard rock, punk rock, rock. These genres of music are in many instances kind of lumped into one. And so anyone who is a rock fan, and visibly so, who wears that fandom in their clothing, in their hairstyles, the big boots that they puncture with spikes, so that they've got spikes on them, that's a freaky.
There are also other subcultures, like, well, the Mikis and the Profundos. Who are they?
The Mikis are the kind of preppier, they would wear fake Coach purses that their family members from here may have brought to them, or that they've gotten via people in Cuba. The Mikis are the ones who listen to techno, generally, or they're more mainstream. And the Profundos are bohemian, more bohemian people, the deep thinkers, the people who would listen to Trova.
What about the family unit in Cuba? Because one of the sad products of the revolution is how it has undermined, decimated the family unit. The family unit in Cuba was very strong for generation upon generation. And then when Castro came to power, he did everything in his power to undermine the family unit. As you well know, kids were separated from their families and had to go to work camps at a very early age, 12 or 13, where they usually were involved in sex at a very early age or molested, and they had to work several hours a day. And they also were encouraged to inform on their parents. How strong is the family unit in Cuba?
You know, my intimate knowledge of the family unit in Cuba is, in terms of the day in, day out, emotional everything, is limited to the family that I lived with for 9 months when I lived in Havana. And as far as their family unit goes, it's incredibly strong, unbelievably so. They are one of the best groups of people that I've ever met. Elaine is an incredible matriarch who is strong and witty and smart and interesting and engaged with the world and so committed to watching her boys grow up into wonderful men. And she and her husband have a tremendous relationship. So I observed a lot of families that didn't necessarily cleave to that model of a very nuclear, very strong family. It's the gamut from their strength and, you know, deep roots and deep commitments to one another to more scattered families.
Well, you say children are told to play in the streets, not in apartments. Why?
I was told that that was because information flows through children like sieves.
They're informants.
They can be without even realizing it.
Yeah. That the government encourages them again to sell out their family.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the ideal situation.
It's not at all. Yeah. And yet there are so many, you know, watching some of the children who would come in off of the streets from playing ball in a way that, you know, I certainly never got to do, it's an interesting thing to observe.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Julia Cook. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Julia Cook, whose new book, The Other Side of Paradise, is an account of her time in Cuba from around 2009 until how long did you stay in Cuba, Julia?
Well, I was in and out for 2008 and 2009, and then I moved there for 10 months in 2009, and then again I was in and out until 2013.
Let's look at G Street.
Yeah.
G Street plays a big role in your book. It's a street in Havana, a thoroughfare. What is G Street?
So G Street is this public avenue that's beautiful. It was actually, when I was doing research after moving back to the States and entering a more historical, doing a lot of the historical research that would underpin the on-the-ground reportage that I did, I learned that it was actually designed by the same man who had designed vast chunks of Paris. So that explains its majestic feeling. You walk up and down it, and it feels just tremendous. It's gorgeous. There are these topiary trees and these mansions on either side. And it's been taken over by youth subcultures. Everything from, you know, we spoke about the Freakies to the Profundos. And the Mickeys don't usually spend that much time there. But they are in and out, as is everyone, it seems, between the age of 13 and 40. And it's a place where people just hang out. They chill in their little clusters on benches or street corners. They drink rum and they rap, they slam, they dance, they flirt, they hang out, they pass notes, they, you know.
But there is deep dissatisfaction among the young in Cuba, aren't there? Isn't there?
There's a deep ambivalence, a very deep sense of anxiety, I would say. That anxiety is a lot of what I was interested in exploring, because I think all youth everywhere face a tremendous amount of anxiety. You know, as a young person, you are trying to figure out how to make the life that you want to lead match up with the life that you are leading or that you will lead as an adult. And so I was really interested in exploring the ways that that anxiety was exacerbated and kind of made complicated by the overwhelming uncertainty of Cuba today.
But the anxiety is for a reason. They can't do anything. They can't leave Cuba. It's not easy to leave Cuba. And they're bored. They can't do anything. There's a one person in your book, Carlos, a young gay man who wants to be an artist, I believe. And he says something that's almost heartbreaking when he says, "I was born to do things in life, but not here." Because none of them can do anything because they're not allowed to do anything. This is a government that is run by dinosaurs. All of them are old. They're in their 70s or 80s. And there are young people who would like to live a life. And they can't, can they?
Well, it's hard. They're trying to... So many people, yes, definitely echo Carlos's sentiments. But what I found so interesting is, the range. I think growing up in the States, I believed that I would only find people who echoed Carlos's sentiments. And yes, a great number of them do. And, you know, a lot of the characters in my book actually do wind up leaving Cuba. And you'll have to read to find out who. But
it's not easy. It is.
It's not. Of course, it's not easy. By any stretch easy.
But I mean, there's a apparatchik named Ricardo Alarcón, who's been around forever. And there's a quote, when young people were complaining to him, "Why can't we leave Cuba? Why can't we exchange with other cultures?" And he has this answer. What's the answer? That, well, if everyone in the world could travel, there would be mass air collisions.
Which is absurd. Absolutely.
Yes.
So, but what I was really interested in was the notion of, okay, we understand that this is the political context of Cuba. What are the impacts in very psychological, cultural, emotional terms on people's lives? I was much more interested in the, you know, we've spoken about youth culture, subcultures. What are the subcultures that emerge in this kind of context? What's the emotional tone of, you know, of life for a young woman who's turned to being a prostitute because she can make money that way? What is a young Santeria initiate who is actually very happy in Cuba? What is his life like? He wants to save up money. And so how is he going to do that in this context? Where does he see himself in 10 years? What about a young industrial engineer? What is she considering? You know, these were the questions that were really preoccupying my mind.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to be an artist? I wrote a lot about art.
Yes, let's talk about art for a moment.
Yeah.
Censorship. What is, how free is an artist in Cuba to express himself or herself? How much freedom does he or she have?
You know, as with everything else, there's a complicated answer to that question. On the one hand, quite free, and on the other hand, not very free at all. It's you know, with the arts everywhere, there's censorship imposed by every... One thing that I did learn while in Cuba and then kept moving back to New York, where the art world is very strong as well, every art scene has its own limitations, is circumscribed by something. In New York, it's circumscribed by money. If you can't make money off of your art, you're not making art because you can't spend the time to do it. You have to have a day job doing something else. And so that's the limitation there. In Cuba, there definitely is a limitation as far as how far your critique can go.
Yes,
and yet there are people who've confounded that limitation.
But the difference is, Julia, that we're, you know, that the artist in New York is probably not going to get his butt thrown in jail if he does something.
Absolutely.
Whereas in Cuba, he will. I laughed out loud when you talked about one artist who had in Cuba who had a series of lectures in her apartment called The Art of Conduct.
Mm-hmm.
She was trying to instruct younger artists on what's the fine line? How far can they go?
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is the antithesis of real art. There is no fine line. Should be allowed to, you know, go, you know, transgress the line.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no transgression of the line. Again, in other words, in Cuba, you can critique, but you cannot critique specifically Castro. No one can ever go after him personally. In fact, I like this piece in your book where you say that, you know, they changed the photographs, they changed the posters of his face, but they never removed them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So you can critique the situation in Cuba. You cannot critique the reason why that situation exists. That seems rather ludicrous and absurd.
So many things in Cuba are ludicrous and absurd. So many things around the world, at least for me, that this is why I write.
Right.
To get under the ludicrous and absurd.
Well, let's talk about race.
Totally.
Because one thing that Cubans here are blind to is how many black people are in Cuba. And there are a lot of black people in Cuba.
You're so correct.
Yes. If you talk to exiles in Hialeah, in Miami, in Gaiocho, you know, they still think probably Cuba is mostly white, when that's not the case at all.
Not at all.
So tell us about blacks in Cuba.
Well, what was so interesting is, again, when I came back to the States to do some real research historically, to find so many different statistics from different sources about what the racial breakdown of Cuba is. The Cuban census says one thing, the University of Miami census says something else, and it just is all a mess. And, you know, the general consensus is that I found that it's about a third, a third, and a third white, a third mixed race, and a third black. And that's borne out by, you know, anecdotal evidence, walking around, seeing people, being in many different neighborhoods.
And how are they treated?
There's a decent amount of prejudice. A book came out in 2008 by a Cuban economist called The Limitations of the Racial Problem in Cuba, The Roots of the Racial Problem in Cuba. And that was actually published by the state, which was very interesting to me. And it found that, I think it's somewhere around, the statistics are in the book, but somewhere around 75% of Cubans agree with the statement that there's a lot of racial prejudice on the island. And the statistics for scientists are predominantly white, university professors are predominantly white in vast numbers.
And the jobs that make the most money, the tourist jobs,
exactly,
are almost entirely white.
They're definitely predominantly white.
You're not going to see, if you go to those hotels, black waiters or bartenders. And so again, we have a bit of a contradiction, don't we? We have a revolution that says, oh, we have equality. But, or we've gotten rid of racism. We've got, you know, they've gotten rid of racism, but oh well.
Well, and yet remember, this is the same government that published this book, this study that discussed in minute detail the issues here. So that is a big change from, or rather, that might happen in 2008.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Julia Cook.
That was the voice of Ariel Gonzalez. He's an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and interviews authors for Topical Currents. Stay with us. Food and Dining is next. Welcome back to Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper, recovering from his back injury, making good progress, I'm happy to say. Joining us now is Cordon Bleu shelf, author, syndicated columnist, and friend, Linda Gassenheimer. Welcome, Linda.
Nice to be with you, Bonnie.
I have to admit.
Yes.
It's springtime in Paris, but it's August and September in Miami.
All right. I'm glad you admit.
I love them.
Okay. Very good. You love it because it's Miami Spice Month.
I do.
Yes. All right. Bargain months at Miami-Dade restaurants. It's a chance to try some of the top-rated restaurants with a three-course lunch and dinner at major, major discount. That's $23 for a three-course lunch and $39 for dinner. And sometimes some restaurants have a four-course dinner. And it's the 13th annual Miami Spice Month. It's August and September, And here to give us a scoop is Bill Talbert. He's the president and CEO of the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. They created and they organized the event. So welcome, Bill Talbert.
Linda, it's great to be back here, and tomorrow is a big day. You know, we kick it off tonight at the Hyatt Regency downtown, 400 Southeast 2nd Avenue, the Iron Fork Miami Spice kickoff.
Kickoff at 7 o'clock tonight. All right. And also with us is John Kunkel. He's the CEO of 50 Eggs. They're the owners of concept restaurants here, and I'm sure you've heard of them, including Yardbird, Kong, and Swines. Welcome, John Kunkel.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you here. He's brought us food. Lots of it.
Always travel with food.
Always. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Our topic is Miami Spice Months. Do you have any questions? Or maybe you have some suggestions. Give us a call. That's at 800-947.
No.
No, 743-957. How many years have I been doing this?
A few.
Give us the number, Bonnie.
It's 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. You can also email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Okay. And also with us is our favorite wine guy. That's Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine suggestions from my Dinner in Minutes column. That's in today's Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred Tasker's wine column. It's changed now. It's on Saturdays. There's a new food section on Saturdays, as well as Thursday. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'm going to talk about the search for affordable wines in the Miami Spice program.
All right. Okay. You're going to impress us. So, Bill Talbert, this is the 13th year. It starts tomorrow. It runs through September. What's new this year for Miami Spice?
Well, we have a whole heritage program. We have 10 great ethnic restaurants and 10 great neighborhoods, part of our heritage program that we've just launched. And I would encourage your listeners to go look at ilovemiamispice.com. I've got it up here in front of me. I stay logged onto it all the time to look at the restaurants, to look at the areas, to look at the menus.
I have to tell everyone, he stays onto it all the time. He's been here in the studio with it on the entire time.
In between the lunch.
That's right.
What do you mean by heritage?
Well, heritage are the great ethnic neighborhoods we have, whether it's Overtown or Little Haiti, places like the Lyric Theater. There are places all over, east, west, north, and south, and it's kind of the people and places of our community that many of us know, many folks grow up in. You know, this is not to detract from downtown or South Beach or all of that, but heritage tourism is really growing around the country, and it's certainly growing here in Miami, and we've signed on a number of restaurants in those
areas. How interesting.
That's
great.
And it's really, that's all it's on really the website. Be, and they're all brand new. They're on our website. Mm-hmm. I Love Miami Spice. It's called Miami Ethnic Dining Scene, and also 10 great ethnic restaurants in Miami right on the splash page.
Okay, that sounds fabulous. Very interesting. John Kunkel, 50 Eggs. Concept restaurants. So we mentioned three of them, Yardbird, Kong, and Swine. And are there more?
Well, we have a lounge called Pat Pong Road that is above Kong River House, and we created and still operate the original store for Lime Fresh Mexican Grill. So we have a lot going on, and we have almost 6 new restaurants coming this year, including Yardbird in Las Vegas. So we have a busy year ahead.
Very, very busy. Now, so this is your first year with Miami Spice. So what brought you to Miami Spice?
Well, it's grown in popularity. The advantage of Miami Spice is you're opening your restaurant up to a new customer. For the two restaurants that are participating this year, Kong River House and Swine, you know, our thought was to really draw people from the beach, so more of a destination dining experience to the Gables, which is becoming a really neat part of our city as far as food goes. And for Kong River House, it is such a special restaurant for Miami because it really is the first of its kind in that it represents Chinese, Vietnamese, Malaysian, Thai, all these wonderful flavors. And, it's a way for people to get in and not feel intimidated about the dining experience. So we're excited to be a part of it this year.
So they know it's going to be. Well, we're excited because you've brought us food. And this food that you've got here is from Swine. And I have in front of me an amazing BLT. So what am I eating here?
So it's a delicious, it's called our Swine BLT sandwich, and it's kind of all the best parts of the South, put into a sandwich. And it's on our spice lunch menu. It is absolutely delicious. It's our house-made pork belly pastrami, smoked Swiss cheese. We have a giant smoker in there that we use for a lot of stuff. A wonderful sauce on there with a fried green tomato and a little bit of a kale salad.
I couldn't figure out what that was.
The fried green tomato?
Yeah, it came out. What is this? Because it's so enveloped in a crust.
It is. Everything's better fried. But when it comes to fried green tomatoes, that certainly is
the case. I have to say to everyone, every time he says that everything's better fried, he has this most enormous smile on his face. It's fantastic.
Well, don't forget the French fries.
Yeah, what's in these French fries? They're so good.
Well, listen, for all of our restaurants, I kind of started with a very easy guiding principle that I wanted to be able to serve my family and friends food that I was proud of, food that I would want to eat. And so everything is made from scratch in-house. Almost all of our restaurants run 24 hours and prep overnight just to keep up with the demand. And we've been very fortunate to be extremely busy in all meal periods. And so, to open it up to Miami Spice is an exciting thing just because, again, it's a new customer and everybody loves a deal in Miami. And so it's a way to get out and try a restaurant that maybe is a little bit farther from your house, a little bit maybe of an intimidating dining experience or something you wouldn't go to, not sticking to your usual, your go-to restaurants. We all have our kind of our track I talk about. You stick close to the office for the daytime and stick close to the home for the nighttime. And this is a way for people to kind of get out of their comfort zone and do some different things.
That sounds great. Well, let's entice our listeners with some other restaurants that that I've noticed. And I chose these restaurants because they're open all week, including Saturday night, which is really nice because that's usually a busy night anyway. So we have Bourbon Steak up in Turnberry, and they have a very opulent menu. Things like Angus Eye of the Ribeye, and their famous truffle lobster pot pie. That's all on Miami Spice. I had a taste of Trapiche, and they're from Tuesday through Saturday nights. Now, if you're looking for a charming, small, quiet experience, which a lot of people ask me about, there's only 20 seats. It's a small dining room, and it's in the JW Marriott on Brickell, but it's just a small dining area, and they have if you have a party of people who want to go there, that's a great place to go. The restaurant, the Satay on Miami Beach, they are having their Miami Spice every night. Summer melon soup, red snapper, they have a lamb tagine that's very good. And they've got a charming, charming chef who is very French, and he looks very charmant, I'll tell you. AQ by Aquilina, Chef Dewey Lasasso's new spot. Every night, he's got rock shrimp. He's got grilled hanger steak and yellowtail snapper. So they're all going all out and really giving you a good choice of things. Miami-Dade College, Tuyo, there on the 7th floor. They're serving it as well. They have a new chef there, and they're Tuesday through Saturday nights. So as Bill Talbert has said, go to...
I love Miami Spice because you got to look at both the menus, the great menu choices, but also, are they open for lunch? Are they open for dinner? What nights are they dark? The restaurant gets to choose. So I spend all of my time, and it'll be in print too, but I spend all of my time on the website hunting and pecking. You can search by area of town. You can search by lunch. You can search by dinner. This new website this year is incredibly easy to search. We used to just have one page and it was all there. But you can also see the value added, whether there's a fourth course. And I think just as a reminder, this is $23 for a three-course lunch or $39 for a full three-course dinner.
And some of these restaurants, that we would be spending over $100.
Easily.
Easily. Mm-hmm.
Easily. And I think what John is saying, me personally with my wife and I and our family, we use this as an opportunity to go to places that maybe we wouldn't go to for the year to explore. Or maybe we felt like we couldn't afford, but we kind of can. But, this list, over 150 restaurants all over town, the new heritage restaurants. And, I compliment John for jumping on board, and I think he's doing it for the right reasons. And it's just one of the most successful programs we've ever had. Of course, it goes along with the Miami Spa Month.
I was going to say,
Bonnie
wants to know about that.
Yes, all about the Miami
Spa. Bonnie knows about
it.
Well, July and August is Miami Spa Month, not to step on for $99, we've got 36 of the top spas in town. So we're going to, for two, I second month, I don't know whether you have lunch and dinner and then the spa?
Of course, you go to the spa first, and then
What do you think the recommend? John, what do you think first?
I think you're going to go spa first.
Spa first.
I think spa.
Okay.
And top it off with the meal.
Do you have a website for the spas?
MiamiSpaMonth.com. Okay. Thank you so much.
And I also understand that hotels are giving special deals as well, so you could go stay at the hotel and have a wonderful dinner.
And that's on the I Love Miami Spa. Some of the restaurants are embedded in hotels. You read some of them, and some are adjacent, but that is a value added over the last few years that the hotels have gotten on, so you can have lunch or dinner and then enjoy a nice evening of some of the greatest hotels
in the
world.
So you could go to the hotel, go to the spa, have dinner, stay in the hotel, and have a wonderful weekend at a bargain price.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. What a deal.
And drink some of the wine that Fred recommends.
Okay, we're going to get to that pretty soon. We're going to a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests are Bill Talbert. He's the CEO of the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, and John Kunkel, CEO of 50 Eggs. We're talking Miami Spice, in case you didn't realize that. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests are Bill Talbert. He's the CEO and President of the Greater Miami Convention Bureau, and John Kunkel, CEO of 50 Eggs Group, with several themed restaurants, including Yardbird, Kong, and Swine. They've been giving us the scoop on Miami Spice, August and September. Get out there, enjoy the restaurants in this town. And if you'd like to have a very special Miami Spice preview, Bill mentioned it earlier in the show, the official kickoff is tonight. It's the Miami New Times Iron Fork at the Hyatt Regency downtown. 6 p.m. is a VIP entrance. 7 is general admission. I think there are something like 30 Spice restaurants are going to be there participating.
Chef, is the public welcome?
Oh, yes. They're encouraged.
Absolutely.
It's encouraged. I mean, there's a small fee. But you get, it's up to 45 restaurants now.
Is it not?
45 of the restaurants, and we're going to go from there. John's having an event at his restaurant. So we're
gonna, that's right.
We're going to double duty tonight.
Come on over.
John, get ready. All right.
Exactly.
Also, Chef Aaron Brooks of Edge Steak and Bar and Todd Erickson of Haven, they're going to compete in a cooking contest. But right now, when you're not going out for dinner, it's dinner in minutes time. And here's a cool salad for these very hot evenings. It's a Tuscan tuna and bean salad with a zucchini and tomato salad. Now, if you can find Italian canned tuna, it's really very, very good. If you find it, buy it. Keep it on your shelf. Or just get a very good quality tuna. And then the zucchini and tomato salad is a very colorful dish. Now, I use dried oregano because it's easier, but I do buy fresh parsley. And here's a tip. If you chop them both together, the juices from the parsley will let the juices from the oregano come out. Yes, Bonnie?
Do you get tuna packed in water or oil?
You can do either one.
Okay.
It depends on your health needs or your tastes or whatever. Most of the Italian tuna is packed in oil.
That's what
but
I was
good
wondering.
Oil.
Okay.
You can rinse it off. That's all right. Okay. And... So, if your dried herbs are 6 months old or they look gray and tired, that's how they're going to taste. So get a new bottle. So to make the tuna salad, I rinse and drain the tuna, Bonnie. And I mix it with some rinse and drain cannellini beans, some chopped red onion, and break up the tuna to smaller pieces, add a little oil and vinegar dressing, and I serve it on a bed of lettuce leaves. And for the zucchini and tomato salad, you cut up the zucchini to small pieces, and I microwave it just for a minute. I cut tomatoes in the same size, mix those all together with my oregano and parsley, and it's so simple and a really nice dinner. And serve it with some Italian breadsticks. That complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And another quick and easy summer dinner, nutty pasta piaf. It's a one-dish meal, vegetarian. It's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, you know, I love Miami Spice.
You're making Bill so happy.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you, buddy.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. It gives people a chance to try restaurants we couldn't afford otherwise. But it's always in the back of my mind that the $39 dinners don't tend to include the price of wine. And as a wine guy, I always want to check to see how much more I'm likely to spend on wine. I was at a Miami Spice restaurant years ago where the cheapest wine on the list was over $50 a bottle. So it's easy to double your bill that way, which kind of defeats the purpose of Miami Spice. And that's fine if you want to do it, but I just say you should know in advance what you'll be getting into. You can go to the restaurant's website to see if they're always also offering a Miami Spice wine special. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. And if the website doesn't make it clear, don't be shy, just call ahead and ask. As I say, some of the restaurants are offering wine specials. The Scarpetta restaurant in the Fontainebleau, for example, has two wine specials along with this Miami Spice dinner menu. For $25, you can have a Hakkasan signature Bellini and a 3-ounce pour of red or white wine. And for $35, you get a glass of champagne plus the 3-ounce pour of red or white wine. Now, that's not cheap, and a 3-ounce pour isn't very big, but at least you know what you're getting into. There's another special at El Eat restaurant in North Miami Beach. There's an offer that includes a free glass of house wine or craft beer with a dinner special. And that's really the spirit of Miami Spice, if you ask me. At Toro Toro restaurant in the Intercontinental Hotel in downtown, a Miami Spice drink special is one called Ahumado. It's a mixed drink with mezcal, blood orange liqueur, agave syrup, and a jalapeno ice cube for $8. And that's just amazing. I'd pay $8 just to try a jalapeno ice cube. That's really cool. And at Tongue and Cheek restaurant in Miami Beach, the Miami Spice special on Saturdays and Sundays offers bottomless Bloody Marys and mimosas for an extra $25. So you could probably spend your whole weekend there.
Okay, so Fred, let me ask you, you found out all this information online?
Yeah, I just Googled the website and the individual restaurants and that sort of thing.
So if people are wondering, they can also go to iLoveMiamiSpice, right?
.com.
Yeah,
.com.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bill. Drill down.
Now, I wanted to ask Bill or John, are you aware of a lot of wine or drink specials that are part of Miami Vice? Or Miami Spice?
Well, I like
Miami Vice.
It is part of Vice.
Yeah. Yeah. We're definitely part of the Vice crowd. But we offer a beer and cocktail pairing for both our Kong River House and our Swine menu. And, we've always been very mixology-driven, and to your point, we had an amazing person design our wine list, Allegra Angelo, when we opened Yardbird and some of the other restaurants that really concentrated on affordable wines. But we wanted to kind of give a taste of our cocktails this time around. So each of our menus has an option for cocktail pairing. For just $28 a person, you're getting 3 to 4 cocktails and along with your pairing throughout the meal. So it's a great deal and really gets a wonderful
So you get 3 or 4 cocktails before you eat?
No. As they're paired, basically you have a 3-course pairing with our lunch menu, and you're getting cocktails along the way to kind of pair with that menu. So it's a great deal and a great way to kind of pair the flavors. We love the idea of whether it's beer, wine, or cocktail pairings with the food. It definitely helps complement that and enhance those flavors back and forth.
Great. Sounds like a good step in the right direction.
I think you see more and more restaurants doing this as years go by. And iLoveMiamiSpice.com. Go to the restaurant and you'll see these offerings. And, there's a bit of a competition between the restaurants, even though there's 150. Everybody wants to do just a little more because they know we're looking at that website, and that website's going to help us get to your restaurant.
Well, when I go to one of these restaurants on Miami Spice, I really make a decision as to whether I'll be going back in the future. So it's really to their own best interest.
Now, it's a great point. We were talking earlier. I think this is such a great opportunity to kind of showcase service and food and really just give your best foot forward for your customers, because that's what it is. It's an opportunity to open up to a crowd that wouldn't normally be there, whether it's price driven or just an excuse to get out the door and travel a little further. This is the opportunity for restaurateurs and chefs to really put their best foot forward. So whether it's from the moment you make a reservation down to the time you leave, it's a time to showcase, what you do.
Great.
And Bill Talbert, Marion says, great addition of Miami ethnic restaurants and heritage neighborhoods. How did you select them?
Well, actually, a number of them, we've started.
Tweeted, actually. That was a tweet.
A tweet? Well, I'm a little tweety bird at Bill Talbert. What we looked at is in the neighborhoods, we have relationships, and we're in all of these neighborhoods. We've now created some partnerships, membership partnerships, if you will, so that restaurants can come on board with the Bureau, really for no fee for a year. And those are the restaurants that we paired up for Miami Spice. A good question. So it was partnerships that we had
so
arranged.
So do restaurants have a fee to become part of Miami Spice?
There is a fee. This fee, and John will tell you what the fee is. I'm not sure. It's in the $28 for the wine.
So. Exactly. It's all paid for. Now, you know, it's a great organization that, you know, we've been a part of for a long time, and you know, they're working hard to kind of expose the restaurants in Miami as a whole, and so, you know, we're big believers and have participated for, I think since I opened my first restaurant.
And I think the fee also goes, you've seen a massive PR campaign. Nobody would be in this town and not know Miami Spice was going on. So that fee is whether it's electronic or it's in print or it's in billboards. I mean, the whole community knows about Miami Spice. So that fee is really an effort. It does drive business to all of the 150 restaurants.
I just have a quick question. We were talking about it before. When you go to Miami Spice...
I love MiamiSpice.com.
Right. When you go to the restaurant, though, do you tip on the $23 and $39, or do you tip on what it would have been?
Well, it depends. Sometimes sometimes I forget, you know, that it's a lower fee, and sometimes my wife will remind me, you know, don't forget this is really double the value, so it depends on if my wife is with me or not.
Okay. But, you know, for us, I think, you know, our goal in hospitality is to earn your business, and that is directly reflected in tip. You know, different countries, different cultures have different view on tipping, but I think, you know, for the Miami Spice menu, it's meant to be price-driven, economy-driven. You know, you want a great deal. And listen, if you're so inclined and you had a wonderful service experience and a wonderful thing, absolutely.
Right.
But for us, it's never, ever something that we would expect or demand. You know, we want to work hard for your business to come back.
Okay. We could go on and on. It's so exciting to have these Miami Spice Months, but it's been a really, really tasty week. Bill Talbert, CEO and President of the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, and John Kunkel, CEO of the 50 Eggs Group. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Linda.
And thank you, John, for this very delicious food from Swine.
Yes,
absolutely.
Thank you.
You have to come see us for Miami Spice.
Okay. Well, you can find out more at, guess what? ILoveMiamiSpice.com. Next week, we'll be talking with Nina Teicholz. She's the author of The Big Fat Surprise. And also with her will be Dr. Neil Bernard, who will give an opposing view to this fat dilemma. It's a one-hour program, very interesting and heated discussion. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And bye, Fred.
Bye.
Oh, Fred, I'm sorry. We miss you, dear.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Free audio archives, downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information on the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. And it's dinnerandminutes.com and ilovemiamispice.com and miamispamonth.com. Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Art Speed. And Monday, we return with a Topical Currents rebroadcast with Dr. Marty McCary, author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great few days, a great weekend. Please stay tuned for Here and Now. It's up next from NPR News.